I'm talking to a man who tells me he was banned from, I think, public broadcasting or something for 25 years. So I've said to him I know nothing about him except I once photographed him from the floor in Listowel. But
the way the broadcasting ban worked basically is people like me, 25 years ago, were arrested coming off platforms and banned from the public airways for saying the same thing now about institutionalised state corruption as TDs and the Dáil are getting paid to say.
And how, come on, tell me more of the story. What happened?
At that time, the whole system was so tightly controlled that dissident was controlled and on the guise of support for terrorism in the north. Basically, anybody during the Eoghan Harris era in RTE, and this paid into the government, and the government wanted it that way in the Haughey era and after. Any dissident voice was either directly involved in the Republican movement and banned outright, or the convenient flag of the flag of convenience, and they were fellow travellers of terrorists, so that also meant they were banned, and by that way dissident was suppressed. And in any society where you get dissident repressed, the obvious place where this will break out is the arts and an artistic society, and these people are independent. But through the Arts Council here, through IGANA, through ISANA, and through the various art committees, with the exception of Listowel Writers Week, and even Listowel Writers...
Which is where we met.
And Listowel Writers Week, I am only half exonerating them. But other festivals around the country, this is how it worked quite simply. If a Republican artist, and there was about 25 was there in that period over the 25 years, got a play or a poem or a bit of literature, awarded a prize, the committee lost their state funding for the following year.
Oh my God.
So therefore, like Nazi Germany, there was a blanket boycott against Republicans. So it just wasn't the frontline censorship imposed by the government, where the likes of me were kept from radio and television.
Were you once on the radio and television, and then you became persona non grata? Were you once upon a time on the TV?
Yes, I was very briefly on the radio at the start of the 70s before they brought in the blanket ban. And from then on, I was off radio and television and only started to come on again. And I broadcast quite regular on the radio now, on the local radios. I do History 1 hour segments on a regular basis, and there's no...
Any
no
particular part
it.
Of history? What do you specialise in? What's your area of history?
Mainly local history, local folklore. My MA studies as a mature student were in the history of the family, but as I've been saying to you there, my people were involved in the Desmond Rebellion, and the Sheehans were exiled out of Limerick after the Desmond Rebellion. In fact, the Sheehans and the O'Sullivan Bears were the only two clans refused pardon from the Elizabethans. And I found out in recent years there, in my own study, that dispatches were intercepted by Cecil's agents in the late 1500s in London. And a brother of an ancestor of mine was actually on his way to meet with the children of Grace people in Norfolk with their descendants to organise a giant rebellion against the Tudors. So when I took this information to Donoghue Coran, the professor of medieval history, or the former professor of medieval history in Limerick, or in Cork University, Donoghue considered it for a moment or two. Yes, Garson, he said, I think you have the answer to the part, and that would piss off the Tudors all right.
And from so, which parish are you from?
Slieblocher on the Corkery border. It's on the upper Corkery border. Basically, the upper arm of the Blackwater Valley.
Is that where there's Michael Hartnett was from?
Michael Hartnett would have been outside the northern area. Mike was a very good friend of mine, of course. Mike was from Newcastle West, and Newcastle West would be north of Slieblocher proper. But having said that, the ethos of West Limerick, where Mike come from, you're very much the heartland of the old kingdom of Desmond there, so there would have been a shared ethos with Slieblocher, and a lot of this, I covered it in some of my own poems. One of my poems to Mike go from childhood, West Limerick voices sang in his head of echoes of a language as yet still unknown. He followed where their traces led and found his Rosetta Stone. From across the broken chasm, poets again spoke, but not in bare or sterile word, for he brought us the singer and the song, the music and the chord. And later, all too quickly, when he went into the cold, dark night, word piles he found smouldering, because of him now burned forever bright. And you had this, the same thing with my grandparents. My grandparents spoke English, but their childhood was, they were Irish speakers in their childhood, and when they spoke English, as Hartnett himself summarised it in an essay, thinking in Irish, speaking in English. And in fact, that's the theme of my own talk here tomorrow evening, because what I'm doing with Dylan Thomas and how my input tie up with this festival is I'm having a look at Walter Scott. When Walter Scott took all these legends out of the, like, Ivanhoe, and he brought these from the Gaelic and French, into popular English culture, and the great themes of those, of course, are romance, the other world, gosh, good deeds of bravery, and I'm showing how these influenced English literature from the Walter Scott era, how he in turn influenced Edward Welch, who was a Gaelic-speaking poet from my own part of the country, and Young Ireland poet. I knew the same movement in Scotland, and the question I'm posing here, I won't be answering it myself, incidentally, but the lecturers here for the weekend, once I have posed it, that people will be able to make up their own mind on it. Each one's referred to his corpus of poetry as an olden songry song, and the argument I'll be putting forward here is a lot of the themes that Dylan covered, as death shall have no dominion, and things like that, that what he was doing, he didn't originate or invent something. He was singing an old songry song, and Dylan's magic is he found the voice and found the methodology to do that in his own time. And of course, having done it in his own time, you could say he did what Joyce did with Ulysses, of that he brought it into, it was an old songry song, but he's put it before a modern audience in a new and fresh way, that give an intake of breath, and Under the Milkwood, of course, today has the same magic as when it was written. And I've been fortunate there in latter years to make friends with Andrew St. Clair.
All right, who was here?
He was, Andrew Lycett is here.
Oh, Andrew St. Clair wrote the other biographer.
I was very fortunate. In 2004, I suffered cardiac problems, was forced into early retirement due to a rare form of angina, and I was able to pursue my interest in underground history in what's popularly known as the Da Vinci Code era, but there's much more to it than the Da Vinci Code. In fact, the Da Vinci Code is a total distortion of it. Having said that, I attend conferences in Scotland on a regular basis, and I always do a few poems for the festival when I'm over.
What I marvel at about you is your ability to literally do it all out of your head. I've never seen you with a piece of paper in your hand in this stool, and just this second now.
Yes.
I mean, it's practice, is it?
Remember, I grew up in the Bardic tradition, and growing up in the Bardic tradition meant poetry is one of the five Irish traditional performed arts. Poetry is the primary one, because that informs all the other four arts. Next in line then, in traditional thing, was storytelling, next to the poetry. Then you had music.
So poetry was superior to
storytelling? Poetry was superior to everything.
Oh, right. Yes.
Goldsmith picked up that himself in his deserted village when he said, the arts by which all others excel. And again, he was mining a past. And I've done a short biography with an exploratory essay on, in one of the books I did there in the early 90s, of Goldsmith, where I took apart his deserted village and showed the influences onto it and what he was doing. And that put in...
Did you go through it all? I mean,
it's quite a long poem.
That's a big work.
Well, at that time, Thatcher's Thatcher's, what he referred to as the Rage of Gain, Thatcherism was rampant. And you had the miners' strike in England and that. So what I did was show there was what Peter Russell, a friend of mine that again I was privileged to know before he died and in correspondence with him in latter years, he said there are certain norms without which we cannot really live. And this is the challenge today, not left or right, it's that these universal norms of common decency, like educating the young, like taking care of the elderly, like supporting a marriage, like supporting the institution of marriage and family institutions. All of these, I don't see poetry as an abstract art in isolation.
We're just stopping for a little bit of food.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
We're just stopping a piece of smoked salmon.
That's okay.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. Sorry,
Robert, I see
no.
all of... I see... Because I am a poet in the first instance in the Bardic tradition and a poet of the sacred. It's incumbent on me then to speak out and to support these values and pay the price that go with it. And I've done that. I've done that all my life, and I would be deficit in my duty to the God that created me, as most Irish poets would, as most Irish Bardic poets would, if I negated doing that.
It's a thrill to meet you here, because we met in the stall, right, mm-hmm. but hardly had much of a talk.
Yeah.
How come? How did you get here? Did they invite you, or did you invite yourself?
No, I was invited to this to be part of it. In fact, after speaking to Andrew St. Clair, I actually proposed, believe it or not, I came back here and I proposed to the hotel management that they stage such a festival as this.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's been percolating away in the background for a few years, so...
and it's finally... And how
I had an
feel,
indirect
are you, input. Are you glad? Are you, how do you feel at the beginning of it now?
I'm delighted. I'm delighted to see it going because Kathleen McNamara, the hotel here was Kathleen's family home.
Yeah.
And...
That's Stephen Thomas's wife.
Yes,
right?
It's debatable.
So in case anybody listening to this...
It's actually debatable whether Dylan would have achieved the fame he could in early years without Kathleen's support. Because what Kathleen did for him was most remarkable. She took the responsibility of the family away from him. She organised even a house out in the cliffs where he could write, where he was looking at Fern Hill in that famous poem of his.
Yes,
and,
yes, yeah.
That gave such a graphic description of it. And I know in latter years that they had less than an ideal relationship. But in the early years and the middle years of their relationship, they had a very productive, association. And I'll be touching on that in my own talk tomorrow evening.
Well, I'm delighted because I tell you what, yes. I actually know almost nothing about the personal relationship between Kathleen or Caitlin or whatever people call and Dylan Thomas himself, right? So I'm here, I'm going to learn so much in the next couple of days. We better stop the audio so that I can put it down. And
I think it's going to be a fantastic weekend, actually.
Well, it's a thank you so much. Will you say your name so that the listeners can actually hear it properly when you aren't stuffed with the food? The man will now say his proper name and in your proper language.
Donald O'Sheikon.
Donald, thank you ever so much.
You're
it's
welcome.
A joy to meet you.
Yeah.